No detail of my life had been big enough to merit my attention. The Chinese laundress could have ironed a hole in my skirt, and I would have tossed a nickel on the drum, thanked her kindly, and worn it to the church social. After all, where I came from, the mission was to pay as little as one could without stealing. So on those rare occasions when you got home and discovered you had the unbruised melon, you had good reason to suspect you didn't deserve it. But Wallace deserved it, at least as far as I was concerned. So if the color of a new sweater clashed with the color of his eyes, I sent it back. If the first four shaving soaps smelled too flowery, I told the girl at Bergdorf's to bring four more. And if the porterhouse steak wasn't thick enough, I stood right there at the counter and watched Mr. Ottominelli swing his cleaver until he got it right. Taking care of someone else's life. That may have been what Wallace Wolcott was running away from, but I found it suited me just fine. Then, with our errands behind us, having earned it, we'd cocktail at an empty hotel bar, dine at a nice restaurant without a reservation, and stroll back up Fifth Avenue to his apartment, where we could trade novels and divvy up Hershey bars. One night in early August, while having a late supper at the Grove, where the potted ficus were hung with little white lights, Wallace observed wistfully that he wouldn't be home for Christmas. Apparently, Christmas was a big holiday for the Wolcotts. On Christmas Eve, three generations spent the night at the Adirondack camp, and while they attended the midnight service, Mrs. Wolcott would put a pair of matching pajamas on every pillow. So in the morning, they all came down to the freshly cut spruce in matching red and white stripes, or a tartan plaid. Wallace didn't particularly enjoy shopping for himself, but he took pride in finding that perfect gift for his nephews and nieces, especially his young namesake, Wallace Martin. But this year he wasn't going to make it back in time. "Why don't we shop for them now?" I suggested. "We can wrap the gifts, tag them with a 'Don't open till Christmas,' and drop them off at your mother's." "Better yet, I could give them to my attorney, with instructions to deliver on Christmas Eve." "Better yet." So we shoved aside our plates and sketched a plan of action, identifying each recipient, their relation to Wallace, their age, their character, and a potential gift. In addition to Wallace's sisters, brothers-in-law, nieces, and nephews, the list included Wallace's secretary, the chauffeur Michael, and a few others to whom he felt indebted. It was like a cheat sheet on the entire Wolcott family. What the girls in Oyster Bay wouldn't have paid to get a look at it. We spent a weekend shopping. Then, two nights before Wallace was to set sail, we planned a dinner for two at his apartment so we could wrap. As I looked through my closet that morning, my first thought was to wear my polka dot dress. But somehow it didn't seem to strike the right note. So I dug in the back of the closet and found a black velvet dress that I hadn't worn in a century. Then I rummaged in my sewing kit for a length of ribbon as red as a poinsettia. When Wallace opened the door to his apartment, I curtsied. "Ho, ho, ho," he said. In the living room, carols were playing on the phonograph, and a bottle of champagne was wreathed in evergreens. We toasted Saint Nick and Jack Frost and rapid returns from bold adventures. Then we sat on the carpet with scissors and adhesive tape and went about our work. As the Wolcotts were in the paper business, they had access to every kind of wrapping paper on earth. Forest greens patterned with candy canes, velvety reds with pipe-smoking Santas and sleighs. But the family tradition was to wrap everything in a heavy white stock that was delivered to the house by the roll. Then they dressed the gifts with a different colored ribbon for each member of the clan. For 10-year-old Joel, I wrapped a miniature baseball field with a spring-released bat that knocked ball bearings around the bases, and then tied it with a ribbon of blue. I wrapped and finished in yellow ribbon a pair of stuffed lizards for 14-year-old Penelope, a Madame Curie in the making who frowned on most amusements, including candy. As the pile grew smaller, I kept an eye out for little Wallace's gift. When we had gone shopping, Big Wallace had said he had something special in mind for his godson, but in taking a quick inventory, I couldn't identify it. The mystery was solved when, with the last of the presents wrapped, Wallace cut a small rectangle of paper and then took his father's black dialed watch from his wrist. With the job complete, we passed into the kitchen where the air smelled of slow roasting potatoes. After checking the oven, Wallace wrapped an apron around his waist and seared the lamb chops that I had carefully selected the day before. Then he removed the chops and deglazed the pan with mint jelly and cognac. "Wallace?" I asked as he handed me my plate. "If I declared war on America, would you stay and fight with me?" When dinner was over, I helped Wallace carry the gifts to the back pantry. Lining the hallway were photographs of family members smiling in enviable locales. There were grandparents on a dock, an uncle on skis, sisters riding side saddle. At the time, it seemed a little odd, this back hall gallery. But running into a similar setup in similar hallways over the years, I eventually came to see it as endearingly waspy, because it's an outward expression of that reserved sentimentality, for places as much as kin, that quietly permeates their version of existence. In Brighton Beach, or on the Lower East Side, you are more apt to find a single portrait propped on a mantel behind dried flowers, a burning candle, and a generation of genuflection. In our households, nostalgia played a distant fiddle to acknowledgement of the sacrifices made by forebears on your behalf. One of the pictures was of a few hundred boys in coat and tie. "Is that St. George's?"
"Yes, from my senior year."
I leaned a little closer, trying to find Wallace. He pointed to a sweet, unassuming face, which I had already passed over. Wallace was just the sort who blends into the background of the school photo or the greeting line at the cotillion, but who, with the passage of time, increasingly stands out against the lapses in character around him. "This is the whole school?" I asked, after another moment of scanning the boys' faces.
"You're looking for Tinker?"
"Yes," I admitted.
"He's here."
Wallace pointed to the left side of the photograph, where our mutual friend stood alone at the outskirts of the assembly. Given another minute, I would certainly have identified Tinker. He looked just as you'd expect him to look at the age of 14. His hair a little tousled, his jacket a little wrinkled, his eyes trained on the camera as if he were ready to spring. Then Wallace smiled and moved his finger across the photograph to its opposite edge.
"And he's here."
Sure enough, at the far right of the assembly was another figure, slightly blurred, but unmistakably him. In order to have the whole school in focus, Wallace explained, they used the old box cameras on stilts, where an aperture is slowly pulled across a large negative, exposing one part of the assembly at a time. This allows someone on the far side to sprint behind the student body and appear in the photograph twice, but only if he times it well and runs like the devil. Every year, a few freshmen tried the stunt, but Tinker was the only one Wallace remembered succeeding. And from the wide smile on the second Tinker's face, you sensed that he knew it. Wallace and I had been reasonably true to our promise of leaving Tinker and Eve out of our conversations, but there was something nice for the both of us in seeing Tinker's puckish self at play. We lingered, giving the stunt its due. "Can I ask you something?" I said after a moment.
"Sure."
That night we all had dinner at the Beresford. When we were riding down in the elevator, Bucky made a crack about Tinker rising like a phoenix from the ashes.
"Bucky is a bit of a bore."
"Even so, what was he talking about?" Wallace was silent. "Is it that bad?" I prodded. Wallace smiled softly.
"No, it's not bad, per se. Tinker came from an old Fall River family, but I gather his father had a run of rotten luck. I think he Lost just about everything.
In the crash?
No.
Wallace pointed to the photograph.
It was around then, when Tinker was a freshman. I remember because I was a prefect. The trustees met to discuss what they should do given the change in his circumstances.
Did they give him a scholarship? Wallace gave a slow shake of the head.
They asked him to leave. He finished high school in Fall River and put himself through Providence College. Then he got a job as a clerk at a trust company and began working his way back up.
Born in the Back Bay, attended Brown, and worked at his grandfather's bank. That had been my smug assessment of Tinker 10 minutes after we'd met. I took a second look at the photo of this boy, with his curly hair and friendly smile, and for the first time in months, I wanted to see him. Not to hash anything out. I didn't need to talk about Eve or what had or hadn't or might have happened. I just wanted a second shot at a first impression. To have him walk into the hot spot and sit at the neighboring table and watch the band, so that when the soloist began to bray and Tinker gave me that bewildered smile, I could take him in without assumptions. For this little piece of information from Wallace told me something that I should have known all along. That as Tinker and I had come of age, we hadn't been on opposite sides of a threshold. We'd been standing side by side. Wallace looked back and forth across the photograph with a probing gaze, as if the very moment that it had been taken was when Mr. Gray had lost the last of the family fortune, and the two Tinkers on either side of the assembly represented the end of one life and the beginning of another.
"Most people remember the phoenix for being born from the ashes," he said, "but they forget its other feature."
"What's that?" I asked.
"That it lives 500 years.
The next day, Wallace shipped out. Well, not exactly. In 1917, they shipped out. Young men in pressed uniforms with fair hair and red cheeks gathered in battalions on the docks of the Brooklyn shipyards. With their duffel bags on their shoulders, they marched up the gangplanks of the great gray cruisers, gamely singing choruses of "Over There, Over There." And when the whistle finally blew, they competed to hang over the railings so that they could blow kisses at their sweethearts or wave to their mothers, who presciently wept in the background. But if you were a well-to-do young man in 1938, off to fight in the Spanish Civil War, there wasn't much fare to fan. You bought a first-class ticket on the Queen Mary and showed up on the docks after a leisurely lunch. Passing among the tourists who were already thumbing through phrase books, you politely made your way up the gangplank and headed to your cabin on the upper deck, where your luggage, which had been sent ahead, was being carefully unpacked by a steward. Ever since the League of Nations prohibited the volunteering of extra-nationals in the conflict, it had been bad form to discuss that you were headed there while you dined at the captain's table, seated in between the Philadelphia Morgans and the Breezewood sisters in the company of their aunt. You certainly couldn't say it to the immigration officials in Southampton. Instead, you'd say you were on your way to Paris to see some school chums and purchase a painting or two. Then you'd take the train to Dover, the boat to Calais, and a car to the south of France, where you could either hike over the Pyrenees or hire a fishing trawler to run you down the coast.
"See you, Mike," Wallace said at the gangplank. "Good luck, Mr. Wolcott."
When he turned to me, I observed that I wouldn't know what to do with my Saturdays anymore. "Maybe I could run some errands for your mother," I suggested.
"Kate," he said, "you shouldn't be running someone's errands. Not mine, not my mother's, not Mason Tate's."
When Michael and I were driving back from the dock, it was pretty mournful in the car, for the both of us. As we crossed the bridge into Manhattan, I broke the silence. "Do you think he'll be careful, Michael?"
"Being that it's a war, miss, that would sort of defeat the purpose."
"Yes, I suppose it would." Through the windows of the car, I saw City Hall float past. In Chinatown, miniature old women crowded around street carts laden with ungodly fish.
Shall I take you home, miss?
Yes, Michael.
To 11th Street?
It was sweet of him to ask. If I had given Wallace his address, I think he would have taken me there. After pulling up to the curb, he would have opened the door to the back seat, Billy would have opened the door to the building, and Jackson would have brought me in the elevator up to the 11th floor, where for a few weeks more I could fend off my future. But with a pile of presents waiting patiently in a law firm's file room, Michael would soon be covering the brown Bentley in tarpaulin, even as John and Tony dismantled the Remington and the Colt and stowed them in a locker. Maybe it was time for my brush with perfection to be dismantled and stowed away, too. On the Thursday after Wallace left, I wandered over to Fifth Avenue after work to see the windows at Bergdorf's. A few days before, I'd noticed they'd been curtained for the installation of the new displays. Winter, spring, summer, fall. I always looked forward to the unveiling of the new seasons at Bergdorf's. Standing before the windows, you felt like a czarina receiving one of those jeweled eggs in which an elaborate scene in miniature has been painstakingly assembled. With one eye closed, you spy inside, losing all sense of time as you marvel at every transporting detail. And transporting was the right word, for the Bergdorf's windows weren't advertising unsold inventory at 30% off. They were designed to change the lives of women up and down the avenue, offering envy to some, self-satisfaction to others, but a glimpse of possibility to all. And for the fall season of 1938, my Fifth Avenue Fabergé did not disappoint. The theme of the windows was fairy tales, drawing on the well-known works of the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen. But in each set piece, the princess had been replaced with the figure of a man, and the prince with one of us. In the first window, a young lord with raven hair and flawless skin lay in state under a flowering arbor, his delicate hands folded on his chest. But at his side stood a dashing young woman in a red bolero jacket by Schiaparelli, her hair cut short for battle, her sword tucked neatly through her belt, and the reins of her faithful horse in hand. With an expression at once worldly and compassionate, she looked down upon the prince in no apparent rush to rouse him with a kiss. In the next window, with the Renaissance trickery of an opera set, 100 marble steps descended from a palace door to a cobbled court, where 4 mice hid in the shadow of a pumpkin. On the periphery, the diminishing figure of a golden-haired stepson turned the corner at a sprint, while front and center knelt a princess, in a fitted black dress by Chanel, looking with determination at a derby shoe made of glass. From her expression, you could just tell that she was ready to call her kingdom into action, from the footmen to the chamberlains, and have them scour the countryside from dawn to dusk for the boy who fit that shoe.
"It's Katie, isn't it?"
I turned to find a prim brunette at my side, Wiss from the little state of Connecticut. If I had been asked to speculate on Mysteria's style for an afternoon in August, I would have guessed Garden Club of America, but I would have been wrong. She was dressed in perfect elegance with a cobalt blue short-sleeved dress and a matching asymmetric hat. At Tinker and Eve's dinner party, we hadn't exactly hit it off, so I was a little surprised that she'd bothered to approach me. As we exchanged pleasantries, her demeanor was welcoming, and her eyes almost twinkled. Naturally, the conversation turned quickly to their European holiday. I asked how it went.
"Lovely," she said. "Perfectly lovely. Have you ever been? No? Well, the weather in July in the south of France is ravissant, and the food is not to be believed. But it was such an added pleasure to be with Tinker and Evelyn. Tinker speaks such beautiful French, and being a foursome provides that extra spark to every hour, the early morning swims on the strand, and the long lunches overlooking the sea, and the late-night jaunts into town. Though, of course," light laugh, Tinker adds a little more spark to the early morning swim, and Eve to the late night jaunt.
I was beginning to understand why she had approached me after all. That night at the Beresford, she had been the odd girl out. But like a seasoned evangelist, she'd put up with the fast talk and the occasional wisecracks at her expense, confident that the good Lord would one day reward her for her patience. And here it was, Redemption Day, the rapture, the unexpected chance for a little table turning, because when it came to the south of France, we both knew exactly who was the odd one out. "Well," I said, winding down the conversation, "it's good to have you all back."
"Oh, we didn't come back together."
She stayed me with the gentle touch of two fingers on my arm. I could see that the color of her fingernail polish matched the color of her lipstick precisely.
"We intended to, of course. Then, just before we were scheduled to sail, Tinker said he had to stop in Paris on business. Eve said she just wanted to go home, so he bribed her,"
conspiratorial smile,
"with a promise of dinner on the Eiffel Tower."
Conspiratorial smile returned.
"But you see," she continued, "Tinker wasn't going to Paris on business at all. He was going to see Cartier."
To Wiss's credit, I could feel a slight burning sensation on my cheeks.
"Before they left for Paris, Tinker pulled me aside. He was in an absolute state. Some men are hopeless when it comes to these things. Ruby bracelet, sapphire brooch, satoire de perles. He didn't know what he should get."
Naturally, I wasn't going to ask, but it didn't make a difference. She was already extending her left hand languidly to show a diamond the size of a grape.
"I just told him to get her one of these."
When I got back downtown, still reeling a bit from my encounter with Wiss, I finally went to the grocer to restock the pantry of my routines. A new deck of cards, a jar of peanut butter, a bottle of second-grade gin. Trudging up the stairs, I was a little stunned to smell that the bride in 3B had already perfected her mother's bolognese, maybe even improved upon it. I turned the key while balancing the groceries in the crook of my arm, crossed the threshold, and almost stepped on a letter that had been slipped under my door. I set the bag down on the table and picked the letter up. It was in an ivory envelope embossed with a scallop shell. On the front, there was no stamp, but it was addressed in perfect calligraphy. I don't think I had ever seen my name so beautifully inscribed. Each of the K's stood an inch tall, their legs sweeping elegantly under the other letters, curling at the end like the toe of an Arabian shoe. Inside, there was a card edged in gold. It was so thick, I had to rip the envelope to set it free. At the top was the same image of the scallop, while below were the time and date and the requesting of the honor of my company. It was an invitation to the Hollingsworths' sprawling Labor Day affair. From a few hundred miles at sea, another act of grace by the right fine Wallace Wolcott. Chapter 16. Fortunes of War. This time, when I arrived at Wyalloway, I didn't have to take a detour through the garden. I got to go right through the front door with the rest of the invited guests. But having let Fran convince me to buy a dress from the Macy's bargain bin that looked better on her figure than mine, I couldn't shake that nagging feeling that I should have been pushing my way through the hedge. As if to make the point, two college boys brushed past me at the door. They sloughed off their coats into the hands of a footman and took glasses of champagne from a waiter, making eye contact with neither. With no achievements behind them, they already looked as self-assured as the flyboys would at the end of the Second World War. At the entrance to the great room, exactly where you couldn't avoid them, representatives of the Hollingsworth family had formed an impromptu receiving line. Mr. and Mrs., two of the boys, one of the wives. When I gave my name, Mr. Hollingsworth welcomed me with the polite smile of one who has long since quit keeping track of his children's acquaintances. but one of the older sons leaned over. She's Wallace's friend, Pop.
The young lady he called about. Why, of course,
he said, adding quasi-confidentially,
that call caused quite a stir, young lady.
Devlin, chastened Mrs. Hollingsworth.
Yes, yes, well, I've known Wallace since the day he was born, so if there's anything you'd like to know about him that he wouldn't tell you himself, come and find me. In the meantime, make yourself at home.
Outside on the terrace, the breeze was temperate and wild. Though the sun had yet to set, the house was lit from stem to stern, as if to assure arriving guests that should the weather take a turn for the worst, we could all stay the night. Men in black tie conversed casually with the rubied and the sapphired and the sautoir de perles. It was the same sort of familiar elegance that I had seen in July, only now it spanned three generations. Alongside the silver-haired titans kissing the cheeks of glamorous goddaughters were young rakes scandalizing aunts with wry remarks, sotto voce. A few stragglers from the beach with towels on their shoulders were making their way toward the house looking fit and friendly and not the least ill at ease for running late. Their shadows stretched across the grass in long, attenuated stripes. A table at the edge of the terrace supported one of those pyramids where overflowing champagne from the uppermost glass cascades down the stems until all of the glasses are filled. So as not to spoil the effect, the engineer of this $1,000 parlor trick produced a fresh glass from under the table and filled it for me. Whatever Mr. Hollingsworth's encouragements, there wasn't going to be much chance of my feeling at home. But Wallace had made such an effort, I was just going to have to splash some water on my face, trade up to gin, and throw myself into the mix. Inquiring for a powder room, I was directed up the main staircase, past a portrait of a horse, down a wainscoted hall to the end of the east wing. The ladies' dressing room was a pale yellow parlor overlooking a rose garden. It had pale yellow wallpaper, pale yellow chairs, a pale yellow chaise. There were two women already there. Sitting in front of the mirror, I pretended to tinker with an earring as I watched them in the reflection. The first, a tall brunette with short hair and a cool expression, had just come up from the dock. Her bathing suit was at her feet, and she was drying her naked body unselfconsciously. The other, in teal taffeta, was sitting at a well-lit vanity trying to repair mascara after a bout of tears. Every 30 seconds or so, she let out a whimper. The swimmer wasn't showing her much sympathy. I tried not to show her any either. Uncomforted, the girl gave a sniff and left.
Good riddance, the swimmer said blandly.
She gave her hair a final rub with the towel and tossed it in a pile. She had an athlete's body and a backless dress that she was going to wear to great advantage. As she moved her arms, you could see her muscles articulate around her shoulder blades. She didn't bother to sit when she put on her shoes. She slipped her feet into them and wiggled her heels until they wedged their way in. Then she extended her long, thin arm over her shoulder and zipped her own dress. In the mirror, I saw a glimmer on the carpet under the settee where her shoes had been stowed. Crossing the room, I got down on my knees and reached for the object. It was a diamond earring. The brunette was watching me now. "Is this yours?" I asked, knowing it wasn't. She took it in hand.
"No," she said, "but it's quite a piece."
She looked around the room indifferently.
"These normally travel in pairs."
As I checked under the settee, she shook the wet towels. We looked around for a minute more, and then she handed the earring back.
"A fortune of war," she said.
The swimmer was more right than she knew, because I was fairly certain that this particular earring, with its baguette-cut diamonds and its clasp in white gold, was one of the pair that Eve had found in Tinker's bedside table. Descending the curved front stair, I felt off my balance, as if the one glass of champagne had gone straight to my head. Whatever news Tinker and Eve were bringing home from Paris, I wasn't ready to hear it, not in a setting like this. I slowed my pace and shifted to the outer edge of the staircase, where the steps were widest and the banister was close at hand. Crowding the lobby was a parade of new arrivals, more flyboys and self-zipping brunettes. Jolly glad to see one another, they were blocking the exit with their fashionably lateness. But if Tinker and Eve were at While Away, they wouldn't be stuck in the lobby. They'd be adding sparks to the hour in the company of friendly foursomes. As I reached the bottom stair, I figured it was 20 steps to the door and half a mile to the train.
Katie!
A woman marching out of the great room caught me off guard, but I should have known who it was from the pace of her approach.
Bitsy!
Jack and I are positively rotten about Wally rushing off to Spain. She had two glasses of champagne and thrust one in my hand.
I know he's been saying for months he intended to join up, but no one thought he'd go through with it. Especially after you came along. Are you beside yourself?
I'm doing all right.
Of course you are. Have you heard from him?
Not yet.
Then no one has. Let's figure out when we can lunch. You and I are going to be fast friends this fall, that's a promise. But come say hi to Jack.
At the entrance to the great room, Jack was having a good laugh with a girl named Generous, who appeared anything but. Even at 10 feet, you could tell she was spinning a yarn at a friend's expense. As Jack introduced me, I wondered how long I'd have to chat before I could extricate myself politely.
"Go back to the beginning," Jack told Generous. "It's priceless."
"All right," she said with expert weariness, as if boredom had been invented the day she was born.
"Do you know Tinker and Evelyn?"
"She was in the car wreck with them," Bitsy said.
"Then you're definitely going to want to hear this."
"Freshly back from the continent," Generous explained. "Tinker and Eve were spending the weekend at While Away in one of the guest houses, and that morning, while everyone was having a dip, Tinker had admired Splendide."
"That's Holly's yawl," Jack explained.
"His baby," Generous corrected. "He leaves it bobbing on its buoy so everyone can ooh and ah. Anyhow, your friend was going on and on about the boat, and just like that, all nonchalant, Holly says, 'Why don't you two take her for a spin?'
Well, you could have burned us to the ground like Atlanta, Holly lending his boat.
But he and Tinker had planned the whole thing, you see. The swim on the dock, the on and on, the nonchalance. There was even a bottle of bubbly and a stuffed chicken stowed on board."
"What does that tell you?" asked Jack.
"That someone's thrown in the towel," said Bitsy. There it was again, that slight stinging sensation of the cheeks. It's our body's light-speed response to the world showing us up, and it's one of life's most unpleasant feelings, leaving one to wonder what evolutionary purpose it could possibly serve. Jack held up an imaginary trumpet and gave it a bum bum ba ba as everyone laughed.
"But here comes the best part,"
said Jack, egging Generous on.
"Holly assumed they'd be out for an hour or two.
6 hours later, they still hadn't come back. Holly began worrying they'd made a run for Mexico. When up to the dock, come two brats in a dory. They say they came across Splendide, run aground on a sandbar, and the man on board promised them $20 if they could find him a tow."
"God save us from romantics," said Bitsy.
Someone ran up wild-eyed, choking with laughter.
"They're coming in, towed by a lobster boat."
"We've got to see this," said Jack. Everyone made for the terrace. I made for the front door. I suppose I was in a state of modified shock, though God knows why. Anne had seen it coming for months. Whis, too. The whole crowd at While Away seemed prepped and ready to gather on the dock for the impromptu celebration. Waiting for my coat, I looked back toward the great room. It was emptying out as the last gawkers made for the French doors. A man a little older than me in a white dinner jacket stood in front of the bar. With his hands in his pockets, he seemed lost in sober reflection. Cutting in front of him, a celebrant grabbed a magnum by the neck and then knocked over an urn filled with hydrangea while heading back outside. The dinner-jacketed man watched with an expression of moral disappointment. The footman returned with my coat, and I said thanks, conscious a moment too late that, like the college boys at the beginning of the evening, I hadn't looked him in the eye either.
"You're not leaving us so soon."
It was old Mr. Hollingsworth coming in from the driveway. "The party's lovely, Mr. Hollingsworth, and you were so kind to invite me, but I'm afraid I'm feeling a bit under the weather."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Are you staying nearby?"
"I took the train in from the city. I was just going to ask someone to call me a cab."
"My dear, that's out of the question."
He looked back toward the great room.
"Valentine!"
The young man in the white dinner jacket turned. With his fair-haired good looks and serious mien, he seemed like a cross between an aviator and a judge. He took his hands out of his pockets and walked quickly across the lobby.
"Yes, Father?" "You remember Miss Content, Wallace's friend. She's not feeling well and is headed back to the city. Can you take her to the station?" "Of course." "Why don't you take the Spider?"
Outside, the Labor Day wind was scattering leaves to the ground. You could just tell it was going to pour. The rest of the weekend would have to be cribbage and tea to the tune of a banging screen door. The casinos would be shuttered, the tennis nets lowered, and the dinghies, like the dreams of teenage girls, would be dragged ashore. We crossed the white gravel drive to a six-bay garage. The Spider was a two-seater, fire engine red. Valentine passed it, opting for the 1936 Cadillac, bulky and black. Along the drive, there must have been 100 cars parked on the grass. One had its lights on, its doors open, its radio playing. On the hood lay a man and woman smoking side by side. Valentine gave them the same look of moral disappointment that he had given the Magnum grabber. At the end of the drive, he turned right, heading toward the post road. "Isn't the station in the other direction?"
"I'll take you in," he said.
"You don't have to do that."
"I've got to head back anyway. I've got a meeting first thing."
I doubted he really had a meeting, but it wasn't a ploy to spend time with me. As he drove, he didn't look over or bother to make conversation, which was just as well. To get out of that party, we both would have volunteered to walk a rabid dog. After a few miles, he asked me to check the glove compartment for a pad and pen. He balanced the pad on the dash and wrote some notes to himself. He tore the top sheet off and stuffed it in his jacket pocket. "Thanks," he said, handing back the pad. To stave off any chatter, he switched on the radio. It was tuned to a station playing swing. He turned the dial. He passed over a ballad, paused on a speech by Roosevelt, and then turned back to the ballad. It was Billie Holiday singing Autumn in New York. Autumn in New York. Why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York. It spells the thrill of first nighting. Written by a Belarusian immigrant named Vernon Duke, Autumn in New York practically debuted as a jazz standard. Within 15 years of its first being played, Charlie Parker, Sarah Vaughan, Louis Armstrong, and Ella Fitzgerald had all explored its sentimental bounds. Within 25, there would be interpretations of the interpretations by Chet Baker, Sonny Stitt, Frank Sinatra, Bud Powell, and Oscar Peterson. The very question that the song asks of us about autumn, we could ask ourselves of the song. Why does it seem so inviting? Presumably, one factor is that each city has its own romantic season. Once a year, a city's architectural, cultural, and horticultural variables come into alignment with the solar course in such a way that men and women passing each other on the thoroughfares feel an unusual sense of romantic promise. Like Christmas time in Vienna, or April in Paris. That's the way we New Yorkers feel about fall. Come September, despite the waning hours, despite the leaves succumbing to the weight of gray autumnal rains, there is a certain relief to having the long days of summer behind us, and there's a paradoxical sense of rejuvenation in the air. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds and canyons of steel, they're making me feel I'm home. It's autumn in New York that brings the promise of new love. Yes, in the autumn of 1938, tens of thousands of New Yorkers would be falling under the spell of that song. Sitting in the jazz bars or the supper clubs, the worn and the well-to-do would be nodding their heads in smiling acknowledgement that the Belarusian immigrant had it right. That somehow, despite the coming of winter, autumn in New York promises an effervescent romance which makes one look to the Manhattan skyline with fresh eyes and feel it's good to live it again. But still, you have to ask yourself, if it's such an uplifting song, then why did Billie Holiday sing it so well? When I got on the elevator early Tuesday morning, I found that, like Mason Tate's desk, it was made of glass. A story below me, stainless steel gears turned like the works of a drawbridge, while 30 stories overhead was a square of clear blue sky. On the panel in front of me were two silver buttons, one that said now, and one that said never. It was 7 o'clock, and the bullpen was empty. On my desk sat the letter to Betty Davis's agent, its flaws faithfully transcribed and carefully proofed. I read the letter one more time, then I put a fresh piece of stationery in the typewriter and fixed it. I left both versions on Mr. Tate's desk, with a handwritten cover note indicating that given his time constraints, I had taken the liberty of preparing a second draft. Mr. Tate didn't buzz until the end of the day. When I went in, he had the two versions of the letter sitting side by side on his desk, both of them unsigned. He didn't invite me to sit. He looked me over like a model student who's been caught slipping out of the dorm after curfew, which, in a way, is just what I was.
"Tell me about your personal situation, Content," he said at last.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Tate. What is it you would like to know?" He leaned back in his chair.
"I can see you're unmarried, but do you like men? Do you have children stashed away, siblings you're raising?"
"Yes, no, and no." Mr. Tate smiled coolly.
"How would you describe your ambitions?"
"They're evolving." He nodded his head. He pointed to the draft of an article that was on his desk.
"This is something of a profile by Mr. Cabot. Have you read any of his pieces?"
"A few."
"How would you characterize them? Stylistically, I mean."
Despite its wordiness, I could tell that Mr. Tate generally appreciated Cabot's work. Cabot had a good instinct for the intersection of gossip and history, and he seemed to be an unusually effective interviewer, charming people into answering questions that were better left unanswered. "I think he's read too much Henry James," I said. Tate nodded for a second. Then he handed me the draft.
"See if you can make him sound a little more like Hemingway."
Chapter 17. Read All About It. Two nights later, an unseasonal snow fell in my dreams. Ash-like and serene, it settled over a city block lined with tenements and Coney Island amusements and the brightly colored minarets of the church where my grandparents were wed. Standing on the steps of the church, I reached out to touch the doors, so blue they could have been fashioned from planks of heaven. While somewhere on the periphery, all of 22, her hair in barrettes, a safecracker's satchel in hand, my mother looked left and looked right and then turned the corner at a sprint. I reached out to knock on the door, but it knocked first.
"Police," a weary voice called. "Open up."
The clock read 2 in the morning. I put on a robe and cracked the door. In the stairwell stood a top-heavy cop in a plain brown suit.
"Sorry to wake you," he said, not sounding it. "I'm Sergeant Finneran. This here's Detective Tilson." It must have taken me a while to hear them, because Tilson was sitting on the stairs interrogating his nails.
Do you mind if we come in?
Yes.
Do you know a Catherine Content?
Sure, I said.
Does she live here?
I pulled my robe tighter. Yes.
Is she a roommate?
No, I'm she. Finneran looked back at Tilson, and the detective looked up from his nails as if I'd finally roused his interest. Hey, I said. What's this all about? The station house was quiet. Tilson and Finneran led me down a back stair into a narrow passage. A young cop opened a steel door that led to the holding cells, where the air smelled of mold and ammonia. Eve was laid out like a rag doll on a cot without a blanket. Over a little black dress, she was wearing my flapper's jacket, the same one that she'd worn the night of the accident. According to Tilson, she had passed out drunk in an alley off Bleecker Street. When one of the beat cops found her, she didn't have a purse or a wallet, but in the pocket of the coat they found, believe it or not, my library card.
Is that her?
Tilson asked. That's her.
You said she lives uptown. What do you figure she was doing around Bleecker Street?
She likes jazz.
Don't we all?
Said Finneran. I stood by the door waiting for Tilson to open the cell.
Sergeant, he said, get a matron to put her in the showers. Miss Content, why don't you come with me?
Tilson took me back upstairs into a little room with a table, chairs, no windows. It was obviously an interrogation room. Once we both had a paper cup of coffee in front of us, he leaned back in his chair.
So, how do you know this?
Eve.
Right. Evelyn Ross.
We were roommates.
Is that right? When was that?
Until January. Finneran came in. He nodded at Tilson and then supported the wall.
So, when Officer Mackey roused your friend in the alley,
Tilson continued,
she wouldn't tell him her name. Why do you think that was?
Maybe he didn't ask nicely. Tilson smiled.
What does your friend do?
She's not working right now.
How about you?
I'm a secretary. Tilson put his fingers in the air and pretended to type. That's it.
So what happened to her?
Happened?
You know, the scars.
She was in a car accident.
She must have been going pretty fast.
We were hit from behind. She went through the windshield.
You were in the accident, too?
That's right.
What if I were to say the name Billy Bowers? Mean anything to you?
No. Should it?
How about Geronimo Schaefer?
No.
Okay, Kathy. Can I call you Kathy?
Anything but Kathy.
Okay, then, Kate. You seem smart.
Thanks.
It's not the first time I've seen a girl end up like your friend.
Drunk?
Sometimes they get battered about, sometimes it's a broken nose, sometimes...
He let his voice drift off for emphasis. I smiled. You're way off the page on this one, Detective.
Maybe, but a girl can get in over her head. I understand that. All she wants is to make a living, like any of us. It's not how she thought she was going to end up. But then who ends up like they thought they would? They call them dreams for a reason, right?
Finneran grunted in appreciation of Tilson's turn of phrase. When they brought me back to the front of the station house, Eve was there, slumped on a bench. The matron stood by in full uniform. She helped me get Eve into the back of a cab, while Tilson and Finneran looked on, hands in pockets. As we drove away, Eve, with eyes closed, began mimicking the sound of a trumpet. Evie, what's going on? She gave a girlish laugh.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
And she leaned on my shoulder and purred herself to sleep. She looked done in, all right. I stroked her hair like she was a little kid. It was still wet from the precinct showers. At 11th Street, I gave the cabbie an extra buck to help me get her up the stairs. We dumped her on my bed with her legs dangling off the mattress.
I called the apartment at the Beresford, but no one answered. So I got a pot of warm water from the kitchen and washed her feet. Then I took off her dress and tucked her in bed in a camisole that cost more than my entire outfit, shoes included. Back at the station house, after the desk sergeant got me to sign for Eve's belongings, he had poured a single item from a large manila envelope. It fell on the desk with a delicate clunk. It was an engagement ring, and it had a diamond you could skate on. From the second I picked it up, it made my palms sweat. So I took it from my pocket now and put it on the kitchen table. The flapper's jacket? I threw that in the trash. Looking at Eve asleep, I wondered what the hell was going on. How did she end up drunk in an alley? What happened to her shoes? And where was Tinker? Whatever their story, Eve was breathing easy now, for the moment forgetful, vulnerable, at peace. It's a purposeful irony of life, I suppose, that we never get to see ourselves in that state. We can only pay witness to our waking reflection, which to one degree or another is always fretting or afraid. Maybe that's why young parents find it so beguiling to spy on their children when they're fast asleep. In the morning, as we drank coffee and ate fried eggs with Tabasco, Eve was her chipper self, telling me what a bore the south of France had been with its moldy buildings and crowded beaches and whists making a scene over every von this and von that. If it weren't for the croissant and casinos, she said, she would have walked all the way home. I let her chatter on for a while, but when she asked me how work was going, I pushed the ring across the table. Oh, she said, we're talking about that. I think so. She nodded a second and then shrugged. Tinker proposed. That's great, Eve. Congrats. She made a startled face. Are you kidding? For Christ's sake, Katie, I didn't accept. Then she brought me up to date. It was just like Generous had said. Tinker had taken her out on the yawl with the bubbly and the chicken. After lunch, they went for a swim, toweled off. Then he got down on one knee and plucked the ring from the salt cellar. She turned him down on the spot. Actually, her exact words were, "Why don't you just drive me into another lamppost?" When Tinker presented the ring, she wouldn't even touch it. He had to close it in her palm and insist she think it over. But she didn't need to. She slept like a baby. Then she got up at dawn, stuffed an overnight bag, and slipped out the back door while Tinker was sound asleep. Ambitious, determined, no nonsense. Whatever you wanted to call her, Eve never ceased to surprise. I thought of Eve 6 months earlier, dressed in white, draped across the couch in Tinker's apartment, dissolving barbiturates in tepid gin. From that lotus-eating repose, she had roused herself to run the city ragged as the rest of us watched with varying degrees of admiration, envy, and contempt, convinced she was angling for a proposal. And all the time, she was laying in wait for everyone's smug assessments like a cat in the barnyard grass. "I wish you'd been there," she said with a nostalgic smile. "You would have peed in your pants. I mean, he takes a week to engineer this song and dance, and as soon as I tell him no, he sails his buddy's yacht right into the ground. He didn't know what to do with himself. He must have gone in and out of that cabin 100 times looking for a flare gun. He trimmed the sails, climbed the mast. He even got out and pushed. What were you doing? I just lay there on the deck with the rest of the champagne. I was listening to the whistle of the breeze, the flap of the sails, the lap of the waves." Eve buttered a piece of toast as she recalled it, her expression almost dreamy. "It was the first 3 hours of peace I'd had in half a year," she said. Then she stuck the knife in the butter, like it was a banderilla in the back of a bull. "The irony, of course, is that we don't even like each other." "Come on. You know what I mean. We've had some fun.
But mostly, it's he says potato and I say potato.
You think that's the way he saw it?
Only more so.
Then why'd he propose?
She took a sip of her coffee and scowled at the cup.
What do you say we liven these up?
Suit yourself, but I've got work in 30 minutes. She found a fifth of whiskey in a cabinet and Irished her cup. When she sat back down, she tried to change the subject.
Where the hell did all the books come from?
Not so fast, sis. I'm serious. If the two of you were so potato-potato, why did he propose? She shrugged and put her coffee down.
It was my mistake. I got pregnant, and I told him so when we got to England. I should have kept my trap shut. If he was a pain in the neck when I came out of the hospital, you can just imagine what he was like after that.
Eve lit a cigarette. She tilted her head back and shot the smoke toward the ceiling. Then she shook her head.
Watch out for boys who think they owe you something. They'll drive you the craziest.
So what are you going to do?
With my life?
No, with the baby.
Oh, I took care of that in Paris. I just hadn't got around to telling him. I was going to find some way to cushion it. But in the end, I had to let him have it.
We were quiet for a moment. I stood to clear the plates.
I had no choice, Eve explained. He'd cornered me. We were a mile at sea.
I turned on the tap.
Katie, if you start washing those dishes like my mother, I'm going to throw myself out the window.
I came back to my seat. She reached across the table and squeezed my hand.
Don't look so disappointed in me. I can't bear it. Not from you.
You're just catching me off guard.
I can see that. But you've got to understand. I was brought up to raise children, pigs, and corn, and to thank the good Lord for the privilege. But I've learned a thing or two since the accident, and I like it just fine on this side of the windshield.
It was like she'd said all along. She was willing to be under anything, as long as it wasn't somebody's thumb. She tilted her head to study my expression more carefully.
Are you going to be okay with this?
Sure.
I mean, I'm the fucking Catholic, right?
I laughed.
Yeah.
You're the fucking Catholic. She tamped out her cigarette and pulled back the lid on the pack. There was one more left. She lit it and threw the match over her shoulder. Then she held it out to me like an Indian chief. I took a drag and handed it back. We were both silent, trading the tobacco.
What are you going to do now? I finally asked.
I don't know. I've got the Beresford to myself for a bit, but I'm not going to stay. My parents have been hounding me to come home. Maybe I'll pay them a visit.
What's Tinker going to do?
He said he might go back to Europe.
To fight the fascists in Spain?
Eve looked at me in disbelief, and then laughed.
Shit, sis. He's going to fight the waves on the Côte d'Azur.
3 nights later, while I was undressing for bed, the telephone rang. Ever since seeing Eve, I'd been expecting it. A call, late at night, when New York was in shadows and the sun was rising 1,000 miles away over a cobalt sea. It was a phone call that, but for a patch of ice on Park Avenue, might have come 6 months or a lifetime before. I felt my heart race a little. I slipped my shirt back over my head and answered the phone.
Hello?
But it was a weary patrician voice.
Is this Catherine?
Mr. Ross?
I'm sorry to bother you so late, Catherine. I just wanted to find out if by any chance...
There was silence on the other end of the line. I could hear 20 years of upbringing and a few 100 miles of Indiana trying to contain his emotions.
Mr. Ross?
I'm sorry. I should explain. Apparently Eve's relationship with this Tinker fellow has come to an end.
Yes.
I saw Eve a few days ago, and she told me.
Ah, well, I... That is, Sarah and I received a cable from her saying that she was coming home. But when we went to meet her train, she wasn't there. At first we thought we had simply missed her on the platform, but we couldn't find her in the restaurant or the waiting room, so we went to the station master to see if she was on the manifest. He didn't want to tell us. It's against their policy and what have you, but eventually he confirmed that she had boarded the train in New York. So you see, it wasn't that she wasn't on the train. She just didn't get off. It took us a few days to get the conductor on the phone. By that time he was in Denver, headed back east. But he remembered her, because of the scar. And he said that when the train was approaching Chicago, she had paid to extend her ticket. To Los Angeles.
Mr. Ross was quiet for a moment, collecting himself.
So you can see, Catherine, that we're quite confused. I tried to reach Tinker, but it seems he's gone abroad.
Mr. Ross, I don't know what to tell you.
Catherine, I wouldn't ask you to betray a confidence. If Eve doesn't want us to know where she is, I accept that. She's a grown woman. She's free to chart her course. It's just that we're parents. You'll understand one day. We don't want to meddle. We just want to make sure that she's all right.
Mr. Ross, if I knew where Eve was, I'd tell you, even if she'd sworn me to silence. Mr. Ross gave a truncated sigh, the more heartbreaking for its brevity. What a scene that must have been. Having gotten up at dawn to make the journey to Chicago, the Rosses probably drove with the radio off, exchanging only the occasional word. Not because they were some cliché of a married couple that time has turned into strangers, but because in that closest of emotional alignments they were dwelling in the bitter-turned-sweet sense that their daughter, prone to self-reliance, bruised by New York, was at long last coming home. Through the revolving doors they walked, dressed as for a Sunday service, making their way through the democratic melee of the arriving and departing, a little anxious, but on the whole exhilarated to be fulfilling this mission essential not simply to their parenthood, but to their species. How devastating it must have been, that first inkling that their daughter wasn't going to be there after all. Meanwhile, in another railway station over 1,000 miles away, one filled with color and light, its architecture reflecting the optimistic modern style of the West rather than the brooding industry of America's great 19th-century depots, Eve would disembark. Without a trunk to pick up from the porter, she would limp out onto a palm-lined street with no particular destination in mind, looking like a starlet from a rougher, more unforgiving land. I felt a great wave of sympathy for Mr. Ross.
"I'm considering hiring a Pinkerton to look for her," he said, obviously unsure of whether this was the appropriate step. "Does she know anybody in Los Angeles?"
"No, Mr. Ross. I don't think she knows a soul in California." But if Mr. Ross were to hire a detective, I thought to myself, then I'd have some advice for him. I'd tell him to go to all the hawk shops within 10 blocks of the train station looking for a skateable engagement ring and a chandelier earring missing its pair. Because that's where the future of Evelyn Ross had just commenced. The next night, Mr. Ross called again. This time, he didn't ask any questions. He was calling to give me an update. Earlier that day, he had talked to a few of the girls at Mrs. Martingale's. None of them had heard from Eve. He had contacted the Missing Persons Bureau in L.A., but as soon as they learned that Eve was of age and had bought her ticket, they explained that she did not meet the legal definition of missing. To comfort Mrs. Ross, he had also checked the hospitals and emergency rooms. How was Mrs. Ross bearing up? She was like someone in mourning, only worse. When a mother loses a daughter, she grieves over the future that her daughter will never have,
but she can take solace in memories of close-knit days. But when your daughter runs away, it is the fond memories that have been laid to rest, and your daughter's future, alive and well, recedes from you like a wave drawing out to sea. The third time Mr. Ross called, he didn't have much of an update. He said that while going through some of Eve's letters, in search of mentioned friends who might be of help, he had come across the one in which Eve described meeting me for the first time. Last night I spilled a plate of noodles on one of the girls, and she's turned out to be a real Jim Dandy. Mr. Ross and I shared a good laugh over it.
I had forgotten that Eve was in a single when she first moved in, he said. When did you two become roommates?
And I could see the problem I had gotten myself into. Mr. Ross was in mourning, too, but he had to be strong for his wife. So he was looking for someone he could reminisce with, someone who knew Eve well, but who was safely in the distance. And I fit the bill just perfectly. I didn't want to be uncharitable, and having this little chat wasn't such an inconvenience. But how many chats would follow? For all I knew, he was a slow mender. Or worse, he was someone who would savor his grief rather than let it go. How was I going to extricate myself when the time came? I wasn't going to stop answering my phone. Was I going to have to start sounding mildly rude until he got the message? When the phone rang a few nights later, I adopted the voice of a girl with one hand on her keychain and the other through the sleeve of her coat. Hello? Katie? Tinker? For a second I thought I had the wrong number, he said. It's good to hear your voice.
I saw Eve, I said.
I thought you might have.
He gave a half-hearted laugh.
I've sure made a hash of it in 1938.
You and the rest of the world.
No, I get special credit for this one. Since the first week of January, every decision I've made has been wrong. I think Eve has been fed up with me for months.
As a rueful parable, he told me how, in France, he had taken to going to bed early and rising with the sun for a swim. Dawn was so beautiful, he said, and in such a different way from the sunset, that he had asked Eve to watch it with him. In response, she started wearing eye shades and slept every day until lunch. Then, on the last night, when Tinker was climbing into bed, she went off to a casino by herself and played roulette until 5 in the morning, coming up the drive, shoes in hand, just in time to join him on the beach. Tinker related this as if it was somewhat embarrassing for the both of them, but I didn't see it that way. Whatever the limitations of Tinker and Eve's relationship, however expedient or imperfect or tenuous it had been, neither of them had reason to be humbled by that little tale. As far as I was concerned, the notion of Tinker rising alone for a sunrise that he wanted to share, and of Eve showing up at the very last minute from the other side of a night on the town, spoke to the very best in both of them. In each of the various phone conversations that I had imagined having with Tinker, he had sounded different. In one, he had sounded broken, in another, confounded, in another, contrite. But in all of them, he had sounded unsettled, having come full speed through a ringer of his own design. Yet now that I had him on the phone, he didn't sound unsettled at all. Though obviously chastened, Tinker's voice was also even and at ease. It had an ineffable, almost enviable quality to it. It took me a moment to realize that it was the sound of relief. He sounded like one who is sitting on the curb in a strange city in the aftermath of a hotel fire, having nearly lost nothing but his life. But broken, confounded, relaxed, or relieved, however his voice sounded, it wasn't coming from across the sea. It was as clear as a radio broadcast. Tinker, where are you? He was alone at the Wolcott's camp in the Adirondacks. He had spent the week walking in the woods and rowing on the lake thinking about the past 6 months. But now he was worried that if he didn't talk to someone, he might go a little crazy. So he was wondering if I'd be interested in coming up for the day. Or I could take the train on Friday after work and spend the weekend. He said the house was amazing, and the lake was lovely, and... "Tinker," I said, "you don't have to give me reasons." After hanging up the phone, I stood for a while, looking out my window, wondering if I should have told him no. In the doleful court behind my building, a patchwork of windows was all that separated me from 100 muted lives being led without mystery or menace or magic. In point of fact, I suppose I didn't know Tinker Gray much better than I knew any of them, and yet somehow I felt like I'd known him all my life. I crossed the room. From a pile of British authors, I pulled out Great Expectations. There, tucked among the pages of the 20th chapter, was Tinker's letter describing the little church across the sea, with its mariner's widow, its berry-toting wrestler, its schoolgirls laughing like seagulls, and its implicit celebration of the commonplace. I tried to smooth the wrinkles in the tissue-like paper. Then I sat down and read it for the umpteenth time. Chapter 18. The Now and Here. The Wolcotts' camp was a two-story mansion in the arts and crafts style. At 1 in the morning, it loomed from the shadows like an elegant beast come to the water's edge to drink. We went up the lazy wooden steps of the porch into a sprawling family room with a stone fireplace that you could stand in. The floors were knotty pine, and they were covered with Navajo rugs woven in every imaginable shade of red. Sturdy wooden chairs were arranged in groups of 2 and 4, so that in high season the different generations of Wolcotts could play cards or read books or assemble jigsaw puzzles, partly in private and partly in kin. All was cast in the warm yellow light of mica-shaded lamps. I remembered Wallace saying that though he spent just a few weeks a year in the Adirondacks, it always felt like home, and it wasn't hard to see why. You could just imagine where the Christmas tree would go come December. Tinker began giving an enthusiastic history of the place. He mentioned something about the Indians in the region and the aesthetic schooling of the architect. But I had started the day at 6 and put in 10 hours at Gotham. So with the smell of smoke in the air and the rumble of thunder in the distance, my eyelids rose and fell like the bow of a boat on its mooring. "I'm sorry," he said with a smile. "I'm just excited to see you. We'll catch up in the morning." He grabbed my bag and led me up the stairs to the second floor, where the hallway was lined with doors. The house must have slept 20 or more. "Why don't you take this one?" he said, stepping into a little room with a pair of twin beds. He placed my bag on the bureau beside a porcelain wash basin. Though the old gas lamps on the wall glowed with electricity, he lit a kerosene lantern on the bedside table.
"There's fresh water in the pitcher. I'm at the other end of the hall if you need anything."
He gave me a squeeze of the hands,
"and I'm so glad you came."
Then he retreated into the hall. As I unpacked my things, I could hear him going back down the stairs to the family room, securing the front door, scattering the embers in the hearth, clicking off lights. Then, from the far end of the house, there was the heavy thunk of a switch being thrown. The remote rumbling that I had thought was thunder ceased, and all the lights in the house went out. Tinker's steps bounded back up the stairs and headed down the opposite hall. I undressed in the 19th-century lamplight. My shadow on the wall went through the motions of folding my blouse and brushing my hair. I put my book on the bedside table with no intention of reading it, and climbed under the covers. The bed must have been built when Americans were smaller, because my feet went straight to the baseboard. It was surprisingly cold, so I unfolded the patchwork quilt that graced the foot of the bed. Then I opened my book after all. Walking into Penn Station earlier that evening, I had realized I had nothing to read, So at a newsstand, I surveyed the paperback fair, romance novels, westerns, adventure stories, and settled on an Agatha Christie. At the time, I hadn't read many mystery novels. Call it snobbery. But once on the train, after staring out the window to my limit, I waded into Mrs. Christie's world and was pleasantly surprised by how diverting it was. This particular crime was set on a British estate, and the heroine was a fox-hunting heiress who by page 45 had already had two brushes with disaster. I turned to chapter 8. Several mildly suspicious people were having tea in a parlor. They were talking about a young local who had gone to fight in the Boer War and never returned. There were daylilies from a secret admirer in a vase on the piano. The whole scene was just remote enough in time and place that I had to go back to the beginning of the seventh paragraph a second time, then a third. After a fourth try, I turned down the wick, and the room went dark. With the heaviness of the quilt weighing on my chest, I could feel every beat of my heart, as if it was still keeping time, measuring the days like a metronome set somewhere on the finely graduated scale between impatience and serenity. For a while I lay there listening to the house, to the wind outside, to the hoot of what must have been an owl. Then I finally fell asleep, listening for the footsteps that weren't going to come.
"Rise and shine."
Tinker was standing in the doorway.
"What time is it?"
I asked.
8.
"Is the house on fire?"
"This is late for camp living."
He threw me a towel.
"I've got breakfast cooking. Come on down when you're ready."
I got up and splashed water on my face. Looking out the window, you could tell it was going to be a cold, bright, cusp of fall kind of day. So I put on my best fox-hunting heiress outfit and took my book in hand, assuming the morning would be spent before a fire. In the hallway, family photos hung from floor to ceiling, just like in Wallace's apartment. It took me a few minutes, but I finally found pictures of Wallace as a boy. The first was an unfortunate snapshot of him at 6 in a French sailor's suit. But the second was Wallace at 10 or 11 in a birch-bark canoe with his grandfather, showing off the catch of the day. From the expressions on their faces, you would have thought they were holding up the world by the gills. Drawn by other photographs, I continued past the staircase to the western end of the hall. The very last room was the one that Tinker